You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1990 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Russ Brierley on the subject, Praising God Through Music.
The music that we're going to look at today is very, very different, but I hope it's much more authentic music, because the real search that I went through was to try and find out how the Psalms were really sung. And when we try and go back to determine what the Old Testament music was like, it's very, very natural that we begin our search with the Psalms. We find referred to in the rabbinical literature, we find the book referred to as the Sefer Tehillim, which is the book of praises. That's what the Psalms are, the book of praises. And the Hebrew word, mizmor, and the Greek, psalmos, the root meaning of both of those two words is to play instrumental music and then to sing to a musical accompaniment. Now, many of the Psalms present clear evidence of being used in the temple service. There are those psalms that we feel are associated with the days of the week. There are psalms which appear to give indication that they were used at different times of the day. There are those psalms like the Hallel, 113 through 118, or the Egyptian Hallel is what it's called, the one which was sung before they went to the Mount of Olives in the New Testament at the Last Supper. These psalms were used on festival occasions. And then we have the Song of Ascents, 121 through 134, which is associated with the steps of the temple. And so we see that the psalms really constitute what one might say the hymnal of the temple, or the prayer book of the temple. Now the titles in the psalm are very, very confusing, and you run into a lot of problems. And one of the major problems I just like to mention, because I think perhaps there is a lot of light that has recently been shed on this. Let's just open our Bible to the book of Psalms, just to get organized here. And we'll notice, take Psalm 5, for example. And the titles to the Psalms were part of the original text. And so we're not looking to something that was inserted many years later, as we do have in a lot of the scriptures. We have something that was originally part of the text. And take Psalm 5, for example, for the director of music for flutes, a psalm of David. There were no divisions in the original text. And you just went psalm, and then you had these little notations, and then you had the text, and then the little notations. Well, it can be pretty well established, and I'm not sure once you understand this great and wonderful principle if it's really going to mean anything. That plus 50 cents would probably get you a cup of coffee. But a lot of study has indicated that all the directions on music really belong to the psalm before it. All the directions on music apply to the psalm before. And all the other comments that you find apply to the psalm that's following. And there are those places, Habakkuk chapter 3. Let's not even spend time looking it up right now, but there you see the complete structure. The announcement to the psalm, a psalm of David, the psalm itself, and then the musical instructions afterwards. And like I say, I don't really think that bit of information is really all that useful. It's just something that I think has come down now and is understood a lot better. It still doesn't tell us a whole lot about the Psalms. The words that we find there are tremendously confusing. There are definitions that you can find, but when you start to probe those definitions, there is many meanings to them as there are people who are studying them. I believe that. You look at Psalm 6, for the director of music with stringed instruments according to Sheminith. And my Bible, which is the New International Version, just simply has probably a musical term. And when you start to delve into these, and I can assure you because I've done it, when you start to delve into the meanings of these, you go all over the place. And it's something that you'd really have to have a tremendous interest in order to persevere. And that's not really the purpose of what I'm trying to accomplish this week. These things, if you really want to get at them and what they are in Hebrew, and I have with me a chart where we have four or five people, Martin Luther and Buber and four or five others that have done a great deal of work in translation, and their meanings on each one of these Hebrew words that we find here, and they're tremendously varied. It's just the type of thing that if you really want to go into it, you've got to go into it on your own. And I'm not going to stand up here with any authority and say that this is what these words mean. But the text of the Psalms themselves and the great beauty that's in the text, I think we know how they're used, and we can get a good sense of it when we go over to a passage like 2 Chronicles chapter 5. 2 Chronicles chapter 5. And in this particular passage, we read these words, beginning at verse 11. And we'll read through verse 14. 2 Chronicles chapter 5, 11 through 14. And this is where we see the ark being moved to the temple itself. And beginning at verse 11, the priests then withdrew from the holy place. All the priests who were there had consecrated themselves regardless of their divisions. All the Levites who were musicians, Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, and their sons and relatives, stood on the east side of the altar, dressed in fine linen, and playing cymbals, harps, and lyres. They were accompanied by 120 priests sounding trumpets. The trumpeters and singers joined in unison as with one voice to give praise and thanks to the Lord. Accompanied by trumpets, cymbals, and other instruments, they raised their voices in praise to the Lord and sang, He is good, His love endures forever. Then the temple of the Lord was filled with a cloud, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the temple of God. I don't think we will ever have any idea until the kingdom itself just how beautiful that music was in the temple. But we're going to try to get an idea of what the style of music was like in those days. A lot of study has been done recently, and it's felt that when the sacrifice of the Lord began, the Psalms began also. And Psalm 3 through 31, many see as a complete service. And Brother Doug Shrimpton has done a lot of work on this. And a lot of it has to do with one of these very words that I was talking about, the word miktam. And it's seen in this word miktam, what is seen as the word atonement. And the concept goes that chapter 3, or Psalm 3, through the 41st Psalm, is one complete service. And as the people came up to Jerusalem, and all males were required to go up to Jerusalem 3 times a year, and as these sacrifices took place, the concept basically is that the Psalms were sung, and that here in 3 through 41, we do have a complete service. Now, while we're in Chronicles, let's just go over to the 29th chapter of Chronicles. And in the 27th through the 29th verse, we read these words. We're now at the time of Hezekiah, and at the time that Hezekiah purified the temple. And we read, Hezekiah gave the order, the 27th verse, Hezekiah gave the order to sacrifice the burnt offerings on the altar. As the offering began, singing to the Lord began also, accompanied by trumpets and the instruments of David, king of Israel. The whole assembly bowed in worship, while the singers sang and the trumpeters played. All this continued until the sacrifice of the burnt offering was completed. And we go to verse 35, and here we read, there were burnt offerings in abundance, together with the fat of the fellowship offerings and the drink offerings that accompanied the burnt offerings. So the service of the temple of the Lord was reestablished. Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced at what God had brought about for his people, because it was done so quickly. Now, when we go to the Psalms, we see a beautiful type of literature. I think I skipped over one short section that I wanted to do here, and that has to do with the musical instruments. And if we could just take a look at our handout, and there again, I was not able to find representations of the musical instruments, and I think we got to realize one factor when we start looking for any kind of information or any kind of pictures, that Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, went through 17 different sieges. There's a lack of any national monuments. There's not one Jewish bas-relief. And there's only a few coins, and those are of a very late date. And what few drawings of any instruments that there might be, they're extremely poor. And so when we come to any kind of a study of the musical instruments themselves, we really have to settle for the opinions of learned men, and far too often we find the opinions of learned men are very contradictory. But if we'll take our handout, we'll try and see what we can do for just a few minutes with the musical instruments themselves. And you pretty much have to start with the Hebrew name of the musical instrument as it is under the little drawings. And the two that seem to be very confused, and the two about which there seems to be a lot of academic discussion, are the kinnor, which we see at the very top with a few strings, and then the nebel, which comes from the word for bottle, basically. And the nebel, which seems to have a sounding board which resembles a bottle attached to it, and a lot more strings, and is actually plucked with the fingers. Now, the only problem is that when we take this nebel, which are the instruments on the lower part of the page, and we look at the and the kinnor, which is the instrument on the top, the King James Version calls the nebel a psaltery, and it calls the kinnor a harp. Now the Revised Standard Version just reverses it, or it actually calls the nebel, the lower instrument, it calls it a harp, which is probably a little more correct. And the lyre, or the instrument, the kinnor on the top, it calls the lyre. Now the New International Version, it calls the lower instrument the lyre and the upper instrument the harp. So you can see the problem that you have. And there's very few sources, and what sources you do have, let's just read that one little section down at the bottom from Josephus. And you can begin to see some of the confusion that you've got in dealing with the instruments. Josephus describes the kinnor, nebel, and metziltaim in the following words. The kinra had 10 strings, that's the one on top, the kinnor, had 10 strings and was struck with a small stick. That's right, as you see them plucking it with their fingers. The nabla had 12 notes and was played with the fingers. And it looks to me like both of these have a few more than 12 notes. Finally, the cymbals were of brass and were large and broad. Later, he says that the nabla and the kinnor were fashioned from electrum, which is metal that was made out of four parts of gold and one of silver. So I think you can see the confusion, but basically most of the confusion seems to be between these instruments here. When we get over to the next page, I think we start to see a little bit more order, and we see the yugab there, which is basically some sort of a panpipe, and that in the King James Version there's four uses of that word, and it is always translated organ. So whenever you read organ in the King James Version, this is the type of thing, the panpipe, that instrument that we see advertised on television with Zanfir, I think, is the artist. That is your ugav. Now the halil, we have two different versions of it here. Looks very much like a little recorder, and it is a flute type of instrument. Probably the halil, and I don't play the flute, but what do they call it? They call that the transverse. That's right. And that's the second one is a transverse, and the other one is more like a recorder that you blow into the top part. The trumpets, the silver trumpets, which were a formed instrument from metal, the hatzozera, you see a picture of that, they were long and of course had your varying tones depending upon how you shaped your lips. We have the tof and the topim, which are the percussion instruments. They're drums. They were made with a piece of leather stretched over a frame, just the same way that we have our tambourines today. And the cymbals, the metziltaim, and these basically were pretty much used as for musical representation, and were tuned. Now you then have other instruments which were not, and the shofar horn, which I brought in and played Sunday night, is basically used just for signaling, and that's the way it's used in the temple today on the Day of Atonement when the shofar horn is blown. It's the message that is to be communicated is done so by the way it's blown, and not necessarily by the tone, by the varying tones, but by the length of tones, and you have some short ones, beep beep beep, and then long blast and then short blast, and there's a meaning attached to all of that. Now the bull's horn, which is the keren, which you see down at the bottom, that is also an instrument that's referred to in the scripture. Now these two pages, that's about all the time we're going to spend with them. because I think that you've got something that you can look at it on your own time and give you a little bit better idea about the musical instruments of the Scripture. It is tremendously confusing. I would like to go on to the Psalms themselves and how they were performed, because that's our main objective for this morning. Now let me just read one short section to you from the Sansino text. The Psalms were not read, but chanted or sung in more elaborate form. The singing was often in the antiphonal method. In other words, two parties sharing the recital. One party chanting a line to which the other responded. Such a procedure inevitably gave rise to parallelism, which is the most notable feature of Hebrew poetry. Parallelism may take various forms, the most common being the synonymous, the thought reproduced in different words. Lord, who shall sojourn in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell upon thy holy mountain? Or perhaps we have what's called the antithetic. The thought is reinforced by a method of contrast. For the Lord regardeth the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked shall perish. And then the third type, which is called the synthetic, the thought continues from line to line to build up a cumulative effect. Now, I think we've probably all learned this one, and when we've learned it as the walking, the stopping, and the sitting. Happy is the man that hath not walked in the counsel of the wicked, nor stood in the way of the sinners, nor sat in the seat of the scornful. This use of parallelism is an important aid to the understanding of the text. A word in one line may elucidate an obscure word in another, and the clue may at times extend to the entire clause. Now, as far as that antiphonal singing is concerned, we're going to do something this morning with Psalm 136. I was looking for a King James Version. Psalm 136. And we're going to do this in an antiphonal manner. I'm going to divide the group up into two groups, the men and the women, and we're going to respond according to the music that Nancy will play. So, first of all, let's get our Bibles open to Psalm 136. And misplaced my own sheet of music. What is it? What do I have first? Woman? Yeah. Men. Okay. The men are going to respond first, and their response will be basically, "For his mercy endureth forever." And let's hear how they will respond. For his mercy endureth forever. Now what do we do then on the woman's response? His mercy endureth forever. And then the entire group. For his mercy endureth forever. Okay, men start, then the woman, then the entire group. Okay? And we'll only do it in the interest of time through verse 12, and then we will go down to verse 26 and do that three times. Okay? All set, men? Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good. Oh, give thanks unto the God of gods. Oh, give thanks to the Lord of lords. To him who alone doeth great wonders. To him that by wisdom made the heavens. To him that stretched out the earth above the waters. To him that made great lights. The sun to rule by day. The moon and stars to rule by night. To him that smote Egypt and their firstborn. And brought out Israel from among them. With a strong hand and with a stretched out arm. Oh, give thanks unto the God of heaven. Oh, give thanks unto the God of heaven. Oh, give thanks unto the God of heaven. We've just experienced that the Psalms were probably sung. It's been a long search, and I'm not so sure that I'm any closer to really finding out how the Psalms were sung. But I want to take you through it, because I think it's interesting. And one of the early items that I ran across was something called the Song of Moses. And one of the comments that was written relative to this Song of Moses is De Sola, a musicologist. De Sola says that a very ancient Spanish work affirms that it was the veritable melody sung by Miriam and her companions. Such a legend goes to prove that the melody probably belongs to a period anterior to the regular settlement of the Jews in Spain. So, brothers and sisters, I want you to know that you're going to have an opportunity to listen to this morning to the veritable melody, that's what it says, that Miriam sang. Val? Did you want to use this?
No.
Okay.
Thank you. thank you very much, Val. Somebody at the Rockford Bible School or the Beaver Dam Bible School last year said, it seems that the veritable melody that Miriam sang seemed to have a bit of a Baroque flavor to it. The next step that we took in trying to get at the music itself was to go to the synagogue and to see how far back we could go in the synagogue itself. Excuse me, once again, I got just a little bit out of sequence. There's one other thing prior to that, before we look at the synagogue itself, and that's on the, I think, the third page of your handout. And this is one other item that I'd really like to share with you. I think it's absolutely beautiful and haunting. And this is a passage from Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms. There's a couple of things I'd like to point out on this page. First of all, we see at the very top of the page there, we see a lot of Hebrew text. And then down at the bottom, on the right-hand side, we see, again, Hebrew text. What is the difference between the Hebrew text on the bottom of the page and the Hebrew text at the top? Anybody see a difference in that text? The bottom of the page is pointed. Remember that, because we're going to come back to that in just a few minutes. Reading Hebrew is a bit like reading license plates. You don't have any vowels. And you have to sort of put the words together and just imagine what the person that paid the $25 for the personalized license plate is saying. Well, the Masoretes came up with a system, and that system basically has all these little dots which basically tell you what the vowels are in between the Hebrew consonants. So what we have up here in the left column at the top of the page is Hebrew unpointed, and what we have down at the bottom is pointed. Now that's important, because we're going to come back to that a little bit later. Now in the center column, at the top of the page, we have what's called a transliteration, which is the Hebrew in the English language. And the one thing I wanted to point out in this was, in that center column, we go down and we read the third line, and follow it along with me, and see if there isn't something that we recognize in this particular third line. Al-me'i menucha inahaleni. I meant to point out that whenever you see the H with the dot below it, that is your het, which is given that very guttural sound. And we see right there in the Hebrew transliteration, the third word in, menucha. And I guess we all probably know by now what that means. Still waters. Let's listen to this, and I think that will be the last thing we'll do today. I didn't really expect to get through this part of it today, but that's all right. Before we close, let's listen to this. It's a beautiful, beautiful, haunting melody, the Chichester Psalms from Leonard Bernstein's work. It then goes into a very abrupt portion of where Psalms 2 is brought in. Let's close our session this morning with the singing of a hymn of praise, number 77. And after which we'd like to ask Brother John Thomas to lead us in a word of prayer.
Glorious with me.